Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
It's a lovely day in the neighborhood.
So, you know, this is a kind of a weird time in history right now, and something that many of us did not expect to see in our lifetimes. And it's very interesting that our book today is also about a very strange time in history and something that people really never expected to have happened. So, Mom, you want to introduce our guest?
Pray to God it never happens again.
Yeah, really.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, of course. Sharon Cameron's debut novel, she's our author, and her debut novel was The Dark Unwinding, and it was awarded the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And Sue Alexander Ward Award for Most Promising New Work, and the SCBWI Crystal Kite Award, and was named a YALSA Best Fiction for Young Adults selection. So this is not her first novel, but it's a good one, I'll tell you. She's also the author of The Forgetting, which is the number one New York Times bestseller, and in the next pick of the list selection, and its companion novel, The Knowing. This one is The Light in Hidden Places, and it's fantastic, and I'm really interested to find out how she found out about all these things, and that, you know, it must have taken a lot of research. So welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So The Light in Hidden Places is a World War II story.
Yes.
Yes. And is this the first time that you've written about that period in our history?
It is the first time. I've written things before I would say that everything I write, actually, even if it's a little bit of sci-fi or, you know, dystopia, has a very historical bent. I base everything I write on history. I think that I think history is what makes fantasy feel real. You know, when we just take things that have been and put a different twist on it. But this is the first time I have written a story that was more true than not.
Mm-hmm. So, and kind of give us a little background of the story and how it, you know, how you happened upon the truth parts of the story.
Yes. Okay. So, I guess I'll start by explaining that I was not one of those kids who always knew they were going to be a writer. I was a musician for a couple of decades, actually, before I turned to writing. I was a voracious reader, but I had never actually tried writing. And so long before I had even considered writing as a career or as anything at all, actually, it was the early 1990s, and I did a thing that you wouldn't think would be momentous. I turned my TV on to PBS in the middle of an afternoon. I was just going to leave it on as background noise. And a woman came on my TV screen. And, you know, it's just funny how small things can become so large in your life. And she said five words, and those five words, I had no idea, way of knowing, you know, they would change everything. And those words were, "My name is Stefania Podgorska." And I sat and listened to her tell the story of her life. And she talked about being a 16-year-old Polish Catholic girl on her own, no parents, destitute in Nazi-occupied Poland. She had sole charge of her six-year-old sister, Helena, when one night there was a knock on the door, and on the other side of the door was a young Jewish man named Max Diamant, and she had worked for his family before the war. And Max was broken and bloody because he had just jumped from a moving train that was taking him to a death camp. And he said, "Please hide me." And so Stefania and Helena decided to hide him. And then they hid his brother and his brother's fiance. And then eventually there were 13 Jews behind a false wall in their attic. And then there was another knock on the door. And this time it was two SS officers. And they said, we are requisitioning your house for staff quarters for the new hospital that's opening up across the street. And you have 2 hours to leave or be shot. And Stefania and Helena chose not to leave. Leaving would mean the death of the 13 people hidden in their attic. And they chose not to leave. And the Gestapo came back and said, well, actually, it's a good thing you didn't go because we don't need the whole house. We really only need one room. So you can stay in this room and we'll be staying in this bedroom. So four Nazis moved in to the bedroom that was directly below 13 hidden Jews. And I am sitting on my couch listening to her tell this story. And it was one of the most amazing stories of resilience, resourcefulness, courage, humanity that I had ever heard. And I never forgot that story. I didn't forget it for 23 years. It stayed with me for all of that time. So,
oh, wow. So what made you decide now's the time to write about it?
Well, so, you know, as we fast forward through time, like I said, that story had really become a part of me. Stefania and Helena Pogorska became, they were my personal heroes. And so we got to 2017. By this time, everything had changed. I had five published novels. I had things like Google that I didn't have before. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to find Stefania Podgorska. I'm going to find out what happened to her. And I did find her, or rather, I actually found her son, because the end of Stefania's story was that she married one of the men she saved. She married Max, who jumped from the train and knocked on her door. And their son was Ed Brzezinski. And I did some shameless internet stalking and contacted Ed. And he was incredibly kind and open to the idea of someone, you know, a stranger coming in and writing a book about his parents.
Wow. And were his, was Stefania still alive at that point?
She actually was still alive. So I went to meet with Ed in Los Angeles where he lives. And we talked over the whole idea and he said, well, what would you like to just come meet my mom?
Yes,
I would actually. She was in a care home at that point. She was in the last year of her life and she had dementia. So she did not know that she met me. But I will not forget meeting her because, you know, it's just how often in our lives do we have the privilege of sitting in the presence of someone that is our hero? You know, when do we get to do that? Yeah, it was an incredible experience.
What amazed me as I was reading your book was not just the decisions that she made, but her little sister and how grown up and mature the six-year-old was.
Yes, and I think that's a sad truth about difficult times and you know, really adverse times that Helena grew up in. It makes you grow up quickly. And, yeah. You know, and she had to make very adult decisions at a very young age. And she was just as much of a hero as her sister was.
Were you able to reach to contact her and talk to her or any of her family at all?
Yes, I was actually. So, you know, after Ed and I met and I got to meet Stefania, I started working on my research. And actually, Stefania passed away while I was beginning to write the book. But 3 weeks after she passed away, Ed and I got on a plane and we went to Poland to research her life together. And so it was there that we were able to meet Helena. And so I got, for a second time, I got to sit in the presence of one of my heroes.
When I was reading this, there was so much detail Did that come from the sister, or how did you, was some of that made up, or it had to be, I'm sure, but I mean, I'm going to tell you, it's a page turner, that's for sure. You just want to know what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it was, but I mean, if this metaphor makes any sense, the life was a page turner, you know, it's almost exactly the way it happened. One of the things that Ed was able to share with me was his mother's unpublished memoir. So I had an incredible look at what her thoughts and ideas and actions were during this time during the war. So that gave me incredible access to Stefania. And of course, I was able to speak with Helena, and she described, you know, to me what it felt like to live with the kind of secret that she lived with, you know, as a child. And but we were also able to meet with one of the children that was hidden in the attic. And she described to us what the attic was like. We went to the house on Tatarska Street where the attic was and stood inside and got a sense of, you know, how small it was. It was not a big enough space for 13 people. It was actually mind blowing to realize that that's where they were. I think you just don't realize what that would be like until you're standing in the space and you realize that they couldn't stand up. The ceiling sloped downward. They had to lie on the floor, and they had to lie so closely together that one person couldn't turn without everyone turning over. And of course, while the Nazis were sleeping directly underneath them, it had to be absolute silence. You couldn't speak. You couldn't cough or sneeze or snore. You couldn't move. And so Jusha, who was one of the children hidden in the attic, she lives in Belgium now. She described to us what that was like as a child, to have to just live inside your own head because you couldn't move. You couldn't interact. There was no privacy. There was a bucket in the corner that Helena actually had to climb a ladder to carry down.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do these people have to do if they had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night? They
couldn't. You know, you couldn't. There were only certain times that any movement could be allowed, because otherwise the movement was heard in the house below. And Stefania made up lots of stories about that there were rats in the attic.
There were
rats in the attic. And Jusha described to us what it felt like to have to lie still. Rats ran across your skin. It was really horrific, but it was also incredible, you know, to sit with people who have not only endured, but overcome. And overcome with such a beautiful spirit. Jusha is one of the most lovely ladies you could ever meet. And she was so kind. Both she and Helena were so kind to me when I came to do something quite difficult. I came to dredge up memories that they would have preferred not to be dredged up. But they did that, you know, in service of getting the story out there. And so they have my deepest gratitude for allowing me to come. Wow. So,
you know, even though I knew how the book turned out, I mean, what the end result was going to be, as I was reading, and it was very late at night one night, and I had to stop reading, and it was close to the end, and it was the period of time when they were being hidden and it couldn't come out at all. And which was not most of the time that they were hiding them. It wasn't so bad. It wasn't as bad.
They couldn't have survived 2 years of that.
No,
they would not have survived. It was about 9 months.
It was
about
8 months. Oh, wow. It was that long. Wow.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it was during that time period, and I was so upset that I couldn't go to sleep, and I ended up turning the light back on to read the end so that I could go to sleep. like at 3 a.m.
I'm not really apologizing. keeping a reader up at night is every author's goal, right?
I just got so attached. And now one thing I was really curious about, there was this man who was following Stefania around the town one point. And we never really found out why.
And Stefania never found out. And that's why she doesn't really find out in the book. You know, the best guess was that this was a member of the German secret police who, you know, who was following her because they had reason to think that there was something going on, in that house. But he wasn't doing a great job of it.
Did she really give him
in her memoir describe leading him at some point on just a goose chase, just a wild goose chase through the city, just walking in circles and just letting him follow her everywhere. And then he just was gone. And they never knew who that was or why he didn't stop her or why they didn't search the house. She never knew.
You almost wonder if maybe it wasn't somebody bad, but somebody who maybe wanted to help, but didn't know how or something.
I mean, well, you know, and I had her think about that because she did think about that in her memoir. That was something, a possibility she considered.
Yeah.
But it was just too dangerous to approach anyone. And he never approached her. Yeah. So.
And one thing that I think is important to know is that she was helping Max's family long before that night that he showed up, you know, that he knocked on the door. She'd been taking risks all along.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, she really did become a part of their family. You know, she, even though she was Catholic and they were Jewish, it didn't matter, you know, in their world. And even though culturally it did matter in their city, I think one of the things that I didn't understand until I went to Poland myself is how much Stefania was actually being a rebel in her own society, not only in her own family, who did not approve of what she did during the war, but just the culture around her. It was quite a taboo thing. But to them, they just loved each other. The family loved her and she loved them, and she was a part of their family. So she was not, you know, when the family was rounded up and taken to the ghetto and she was left outside because she was Catholic, she was not going to let them starve. That was not in her nature.
And it was amazing how she got into the ghetto and out again, you know, those.
Yes. And I think, you know, one of the things about reading that memoir, when I try to explain, when people ask me what's true in the book and what isn't, I tried to explain that as well as I could in the author's note. But, you know, everything that is in the book happened, you know, every incident that's in the book actually happened. The real difference is I couldn't include it all. There was so much of her getting in and out of the ghetto. It was amazing. She should have been caught 100 times. And honestly, I think if I included all of it, I'm not sure anyone would read the book because it seems unbelievable. And yet it was real. That is what happened. But she was very clever and she was very bold. And she managed to get in and out a lot. Yes.
Maybe that was why she was able to do that, because she was bold. She didn't look like she was fearful and, you know, attract attention that way.
I think that was it. And I also think she was very charming, and she had a way about her. And this is something that, you know, the people who knew her, described to me, and her son described to me, she was a charming person. And she was very at ease and very friendly, and she tended to put you at your ease. And and I think that really suited her well when she was stopped by those in authority. She wriggled her way out of a lot of things.
She must have been very pretty, too.
I think she was. I think she was a beautiful girl. And I think it's one of those things too, where it was an outer and an inner beauty. I think that people were just very naturally attracted not only to her, but to her spirit, because she was that kind of person.
Now, Sharon, you've written mostly for young adults in the past. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that is accurate. You know, it's certainly the way my books are marketed. And of course, I write with Scholastic, and that's, you know, what they do. I would say over the years that just based on the emails that I get and the, you know, and the communications that I receive from readers, that maybe 65% of my readers have always been adults. So I tend to think that I sort of write for everyone.
Right.
Everyone's stories. Yeah.
You know, I do read a lot of young adult books for the show and for our interviews, and I enjoy them every bit as much as ones written for adults.
Yeah, I think a good story is a good story.
Absolutely.
And the rest is just marketing.
Yeah.
Right.
And I've never deliberately written a story for any age, actually. Maybe don't tell Scholastic that. But I've never done it deliberately. I just write the way it comes out, and I let them figure out the rest of it.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sharon Cameron, author of The Light in Hidden Places, a novel based on a true story of remarkable heroism during World War II. It still just amazes me this 16-year-old and a 6-year-old could pull this off. It's just unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
So, Sharon, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
Okay, I can do that. I thought I'd maybe read the very first scene. The story starts a bit in the middle and then goes into a flashback. So I'm going to read you the very first scene, the very first pages of the book,
great,
actually. Chapter 1, Chemish, Poland, November 1942. Someone is out there, in the dark. I open my eyes, and the dark is the same as always, a blank page. I can smell the cabbage Emelika boiled 2 floors below us, feel the sigh beside me that is my sister's sleeping breath. But the dark has also changed. There's an echo inside it, a sound my ears have missed. Someone is here. Now I am awake. I fold back the blanket, quiet, listening, stretching my legs to the floor. A mattress spring pops like a gunshot. My sister breathes, but she doesn't stir. If someone is here, they are not in this room. I tiptoe barefoot across and put a finger to the edge of the rug I've nailed over the window. The street lights glare, hard bits of snow glinting like dust as they fall through the light. But the sidewalk below my building is deserted. The windows across the street, rows of dead eyes, dark with curtains and dresses and rugs, like mine are. In Chemish, light is like a candy poster, and it's not smart to hang signs showing where the sweets are. I let the rug fall back into place and go to the door, pressing an ear to the wood before I turn the lock. The empty hall outside our room stretches to the other empty rooms of the empty apartment, as it should. Everything is as it should be. And then a noise shoots through the silence, louder than a gun, a grenade of fear inside my chest, and I know the sound I have missed. Someone is knocking on my front door. They know, they know, they know. The words beat with my blood. Another mattress spring pops, and I feel Helena coming up behind me. She doesn't speak. She is 6 years old and doesn't have to be told that this is not the time for questions. The knocking comes again, louder, this time with a whisper through the cracks. Stefania? It's a trick. The Gestapo want me to open the door without a fuss, so they don't have to break it down, so they can give a nice, unblemished apartment to some nice German officer and his law-abiding wife with clean hair and mended stockings. Maybe this means they will shoot me outside, like Mr. Schwartzer. The whisper comes again. Open the door. Fuchsia. The Gestapo do not know me by that name. I run for the door, hands out, fingers already searching for the newly repaired lock. I know it isn't him. It can't be him. But I fumble and twist at the lock anyway, then fling open the door. Helena gasps. Or maybe the gasp comes from me, because the bare bulb hanging in the hallway has shown me that it's not him. It's not who I thought it would be at all. Max, I whisper.
And that was Sharon Cameron reading from The Light in Hidden Places. Now, Stefania's memoir was written in Polish, I presume?
There was a Polish version, but there was also a version that she wrote in English.
Oh.
And that's the one I read. I did not attempt to read the Polish version, but the English version was interesting. English was not her second or even third language. Occasionally you had to really sort of delve and try to understand, you know, what she was trying to say and what was happening. There was a cleaned up version that they had actually paid a writer to come in at one point, I think in maybe the late 80s, and just clean up the grammar and that kind of thing. So sometimes I would refer to that version, but actually the version in the broken English was the one. Because even though, you know, sometimes you weren't quite sure what she meant. She referred to poison gas as air pollution. And, you know, it took me a moment for her to understand, you know, what she meant. But even so, the voice and the personality was there. It was leaping off the page. And it so informed, you know, the personality I tried to put in the book. So I hope she would be pleased.
I bet she would be.
Oh, I'm sure she is.
I noticed that The Light in Hidden Places is being produced in a number of foreign countries.
Yes, we've had 15 foreign sales so far, which is so exciting. It's exciting because I'm just so thrilled to have this story not just in the US but widely in the world. I think we were so thrilled with the sale in Poland. That was a huge one to me, and also to Ed, Stefania's son, that meant a lot. It meant that Helena, who does not read English, is going to be able to, you know, read the book, and that means a lot. And also Israel is publishing the book, and also Germany. Which was
really
a surprise. Yeah, that was a surprise to me. But they're very excited to publish the book, and I think that's really meaningful too.
It is.
And it is. Oh gosh, yes. That's really good news. That's very
yes.
good news.
Well, Germany has really done an amazing job of owning up to the responsibility for what their nation did in World War
yes.
II. Much more so than, for example, the U.S. has ever owned up to the harm
yeah.
that was caused by slavery or by what we did to the Native Americans, you know, what the settlers did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
I think they are an example. They're setting a good example.
I would have to agree with that. I was just so honored. You know, that they would choose the book for the German people to read. So,
yeah. Is there more interest in World War II novels and memoirs right now because of, I think we're at like a 75th anniversary of D-Day,
yes,
maybe?
Yeah. I think it's we're at the 75th of the, I believe, is it the end of the war? I'm trying to remember which 75th it is. Yeah. You know, it's funny because there has been some talk about that, but I think World War II has been a very robust genre of its own, really, for several years now. And I'm surprised when I go and I, you know, speak to schools or universities or different places, you know, that I've been going to talk about the book, how many people say to me, and, you know, kids, adults, college students, all the ages say to me, you know, I just can't get enough novels about World War II. I can't get enough novels of the Holocaust. And that has come as a surprise to me. But I think it's just such a heady time in our history. And it's such a time that in some way should have never, ever happened. It feels unbelievable that it happened. And I think that novels like this are important for that. I'm very glad that is the way it is right now, because I think this is something that cannot be lost. It cannot be lost. It can't, you know, die in memories. And the people who experience these things are almost gone. Mm-hmm. You know, there's very few of them left. And so I think it's important to have books like The Light in Hidden Places. And I think it's important to have them as fiction, actually. And I love memoir and I love nonfiction. I'm not knocking any of those things, but I think fiction allows you to experience someone else's life in a way that is different than other media. Experience is incredibly different than knowing some facts. And that was my experience being in Poland. You know, I was very knowledgeable about World War II and the Holocaust. And, you know, I knew the timeline. I knew the things that had happened. I knew what happened in the camps. But when I went to Auschwitz and stood inside the gas chambers, as part of the tour, they take you in as a group and they put you inside the gas chamber and they let you stand there for 3 to 4 minutes, maybe. And it's concrete, stained concrete walls, you know, concrete floor. It's dank and dim. And frankly, it stinks and will probably always stink. And I came out of that. I stepped out of that place, that horrible, horrible place. And I thought, I knew nothing about the Holocaust. I may have known facts in my head, but facts do not replace the experience, even if it's just a little sliver of a secondhand experience. When you experience something like that, when you feel it, that's when you're never going to forget it. Those facts will fade away, but when you feel it, that isn't going to go away. You will not forget that. And that's why I think we have to have these books, because even if that experience is secondhand through a story, I think we need that secondhand experience of walking in someone like Stefania Podgorska's shoes, you know, and feeling the weight of each decision as she made it. And I think we need to feel that so that we won't ever forget it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenge of a book like this.
Yes. And I, like I said earlier, I did feel it so much that I couldn't sleep.
Yeah. And that's going to stick with you. Yeah. I hope that's what sticks with us. And I hope it's what challenges us as well. You know, not only to ask ourselves the question, could I open the door? Could I open to that knock at the door? But also, what choice am I going to make right now today? Because, you know, Stefania Podgorska had no idea that her choices were going to be life-changing or momentous. She didn't know that, not at the time. And, you know, and I think the challenge is what are we going to choose right now? It's why these stories are stories of now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Not just stories of then. And I think that's part of why we want to read them now, because the challenge is what are we going to choose right now?
You're absolutely right. And I know that all of us, or most of us anyway, when we were young and we read The Diary of Anne Frank and we thought, oh, if we were there, we'd help. We would hide someone. We would save someone. And yet there are situations now, you know, people fleeing that type of persecution in various countries, and we're turning them away.
Yes.
We're turning them away. And maybe you or I don't agree with turning them away, but what are we actually doing to change that?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And therein lies the challenge, you know, and it's not like Stefania Podgorska made a decision to flout the entire Nazi regime. You know, that was not the decision. The choice was very, very simple when it came down to it. And that was, she chose humanity over hatred. And it was those small choices on a daily basis. Those were the ones that made the difference. A lot of what I talk about when I go and talk, is particularly in schools, when I talk about this story, is that, you know, Stefania's choice was not actually made when she decided to hide one Jew. The choice was made years before that. And this was something that I listened to her describe in one of her oral interviews, and that I put almost word for word, as she said it, into the book, where she witnessed a fight on the street of Shemesh. And it was two boys that were pummeling each other. And the fight had started because one boy called the other a dirty Jew. And the crowd kind of got in on it and said, you know, dirty Jew, filthy Jew. And she went back to the store, to this little grocery store of the Diamant family, the Jewish family that she was working for. And she locked herself in the bathroom and she stood in front of the mirror and she just touched the skin of her face and she touched the skin of her arm and she looked at her skin and she decided, that's where she made a decision. She decided, my skin is just skin. It is no different than any other skin. And that's where the choice was made. And it's a choice that seemed small in a way. It was only in her own head. It didn't change anything that she was actually doing. But that's where the choice was made. And that small choice led to the bigger choice that led to the bigger choice that forever changed the lives of 13 people and their children and their grandchildren and the great-grandchildren, and eventually changed the world. And don't our choices have the same potential?
Wow. Well, that's...
Yes, they do.
That's deep.
Yes, it is. But I think that, and I guess to me, that's what I pull. That's what I pull from her story. And that's why her story means so much to me, because that's where I challenge myself with her story. What small decisions am I making every day? We're faced, you know, with so many things that people have been faced with again and again and again, you know, throughout history. I feel like there's nothing really new, you know, under the sun. These are, and I think that's why it's so good to have, you know, historical novels, so we can see those patterns you know, that human beings, you know, fall into. And again, I think it all comes down to, you know, Stefania Podgorska was an ordinary teenager living a very ordinary life. So what are we as ordinary people? You know, we can't run a country, but what can we do? You know, just ourselves. And those are the choices she made.
Wow.
And she changed the world.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sharon Cameron, author of The Light in Hidden Places. Did Stefania talk about her experiences much with her children, like with her son? I know some survivors do not. They don't talk about it afterwards.
Yes. What I found is that some things were discussed and other things were not discussed at all. Mm. So it was an interesting situation in that when I first started writing the book and Ed shared his mother's memoir with me, he had not actually read his mother's memoir. For several reasons. First, because, you know, he felt like he knew the stories. He felt like he knew what happened. These were stories that that he had been hearing, you know, all of his life, and about both of his parents. And so he felt like he knew. But when we dug deep into that memoir, there was a lot there that she had not discussed anywhere else, that she had just written down. And I think things that were a little deeper, that were a little, maybe even more painful, those things went into the memoir. And so there were things that we had to discuss that he had not realized, you know, what that was like. And I'm not speaking for him. I'm speaking about conversations that we have had, you know, between those experiences and going back to Poland and to the city of Siemisz. I think Ed came back knowing his parents in a very different way than when he left.
So his parents came to the U.S. They emigrated at some point. And
yeah.
What was yeah. Max's profession?
Max was a dentist. So he was actually practicing before the war as a dental assistant, but he had his medical degree before the war. Even after liberation, anti-Semitism was just rampant in Poland. There were vigilante groups breaking down doors, you know, going after anyone that was left to finish what Hitler had started. That was the goal. And so the family eventually changed their name to Brzezinski, which is why Ed has the name he has. So Max changed his name to Joe Brzezinski. They eventually immigrated to Israel for a short time and then to the United States. When he got to the United States, he discovered that his medical degree was not going to be recognized. So mm-hmm. he went back to school for a second time and got a second medical degree, even though he had been practicing for many years. And he did that while he was learning English. And he did very well. And eventually they ended up in Los Angeles to be nearer their son.
Okay, I want to back up a little bit to what you said about in Poland after
yeah.
the war.
There was yes. Why was that? What was going on?
Well, anti-Semitism did not come just with the Germans. You know, that is
I know.
Yes, that is something that was rampant even before. You know, I don't think people who felt strongly, you know, about Jews they didn't feel emboldened necessarily, you know, to do things about it. But after the war, they did. And so, yes, there was a situation after the war, after Stefania and Max were married, that that people did try to break down the door, because they knew that a family named Diamant lived there, and in their city that was a very Jewish name.
Well, I know Hitler had to have a scapegoat for his rise to power, and he had to blame somebody for the, you know,
absolutely
World War. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But, absolutely.
So who actually controlled Poland after World War II?
Russia.
And of course, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Russia as well.
Absolutely. And it became a communist country. And so eventually what precipitated their immigration to Israel was that Max was no longer going to be allowed to practice dentistry without joining the Communist Party. And he did not want to be a communist. It is important, an important part of the story, I think, to note that both Stefania and Helena were rejected by their family. They were disowned by their family for hiding Jews during the Holocaust.
Oh, my.
And yes, so Helena was actually raised by Stefania and Max. She stayed with them until she went to university. And she became a doctor, and she stayed in Poland under the communists. But Stefania and Joe, by that point, decided to leave because he did not want to be part of the Communist Party.
Wow. So they stayed quite a while, if it was long enough for Helena to become an adult.
Yes. And I think they were there until she was maybe 17, 18, you know, ready to go off to university at that point.
And where was Ed born?
Ed was actually born in Boston.
Okay.
Yes.
So not till after they moved to the U.S.
That's right. That's right. Because of the what we think were medical experiments that were done to Stefania during the war. She was told she would never have children. Mm-hmm. But they did have a daughter and a son, and it was a miracle.
Wow. So Sharon, when you started, you know, you decided to write a book about the story, and you found Ed and you've got the memoir, but at what point did you actually start writing it?
I started writing, I started writing a little bit and kind of playing with how I wanted to structure the story. Then I got the memoir and I wrote maybe 90 pages. And then I went to Poland and I was hesitating to write too much until after my trip, which I think was probably a good instinct because I scrapped a good bit of what I had. And I actually started writing on the plane over the Atlantic on the way home. Because I knew exactly at that point, I had such a clear vision of what I wanted to do with the book and how I wanted it to feel after having all of those experiences in Poland. And actually, I wrote the book in about 4.5 to 5 weeks at that point, which is ridiculous, but I also didn't do anything else. I'm very lucky to have a saint-like husband who just did all the shopping and all the errands and put a plate in front of me and took it away.
And so, oh yeah, for sure.
I stayed in my zone, and the story just poured out. It poured out in a different way than I've ever had a story pour out. But I just came back from that trip very clear-eyed with how I wanted this to be. And so that's what I wrote. And I gave it to my editor and we did some line edits, but we did no revision. It was pretty much what
wow.
I wrote.
So right,
yeah.
What you see is what you get. Yeah.
That's pretty much the way it went. Yes.
Now it's written in first person.
Yes, it is.
And
it is.
So the point of view is Stefania's throughout the book.
Yes.
True?
And I had originally started thinking I would write this in third person, you know, a lot of historical fiction, that's kind of, you know, the standard mm-hmm. way to be in, you know, third person past tense. And I thought that's how I was going to do it. But when I came back from Poland, I realized, no, I think the reader needs to feel her thought processes. I think the reader needs to walk those thoughts inside her head as they happen. You know, I wanted them to feel the weight of how hard some of those decisions were, you know, that they were not easy snap decisions. And so I switched to first person, which is maybe a little more unusual of a choice for this kind of novel, but I felt like in this case it was important because of the way I want the reader, the way I wanted the reader to feel, and I wanted them to be in her head.
Mm-hmm. And except for the intro that you read, is the book pretty much in chronological order?
Yes. So the book starts with that short scene with the knock on the door, and then goes backwards to Stefania's earlier life when she's living on a farm with all of her brothers and sisters before she goes to the big city of Shemesh, which is what she wanted. And it works its way up to the knock on the door again, and then goes back into present tense.
Yeah. Okay. So you change from present into past and then back into present.
Correct.
Okay. So
it's amazing how many people don't notice that, but I think you kind of feel the difference because suddenly when it goes back into present, it's a little more immediate.
Yeah. I can't say that I noticed it at the time.
Mm-hmm. But... No, me neither.
But that is the structure.
Okay.
There's a great big flashback.
Yeah. And it sounds like the structure wasn't something that you, I mean, other than the fact that you started out with a different structure to begin with, and then you scrapped that. But once you got started, it wasn't something that you had to really think about. It just, you knew.
It was the way it flowed, and it felt good. You know, I base a lot of my writing, for better or worse, I'm not saying this is the right way to do it, but I do base a lot of my writing on the feel of it. And if it's flowing and it feels good, I know I'm doing something right. And when it doesn't, I'm doing something wrong. So in this case, that's very scholarly of me, but that is the way I thought. You know, in this case, it flowed, and that's the way it flowed. And that felt good the whole time. And it felt good to my critique group that I have read with me, and it felt good to my editor. So that's what we went with.
Did you give Ed any sort of right to say, oh, don't include this, or I don't want this in part in the story?
I didn't give him a contractual right. You know, that wasn't in our contract per se. However, what I wanted more than anything was to honor his mother. And, you know, I didn't feel like I could do that by offending her family.
Good point.
So I tried to be very considerate, and we did have conversations, you know, about how do you feel about this being in the book? How do you, and there were things that we, for privacy purposes, we decided not to include. Mm-hmm. And I feel, I'm glad we did that. Because that the family was more comfortable with that. We did give the family a read, and afterward, and discussed anything that didn't feel right to them. Though I have to say, you know, there's no way, and I knew there was no way in writing this novel that I was going to really get this right in the eyes of the family. You know, I made sure that they understood that this is overall a work of fiction, even though every incident that's in there happened in her memoir. And I, in the author's note in the end, I specify where I took a little license or I adjusted a timeline, you know, since life doesn't happen exactly like a novel, you know, and I put that in the back of the book so it would be really clear. But I knew there was no way in the eyes of the family to get all of this right. You know, I was never going to present their mother in exactly the way that they would remember their mother or their sister or, you know, whatever the relationships were. So I made sure they understood that this was a fictionalized version, because all I can do is put my vision on it. And of course, it's going to have my vision on it. And you know, I'm writing about their mom at a time of her life when they didn't know her, you know, when she was a different person. And so anyway, all this is to say that the scariest thing I've ever done in my life was send this manuscript to Ed Brzezinski.
Well, now on the cover, on the back cover, Ed says, "I hear my mom's voice in this story, and this book exceeds all my expectations." So I think that's pretty nice endorsement.
It was glowing and more than I expected. Absolutely more than it exceeded my expectation that way. And it meant an incredible amount to me. And Ed and I have actually been, we did a little bit of touring together. And we have been, you know, trying to take his mom's story, you know, out into the world. And, it's been such an interesting experience, you know, doing this with a family member, you know, and he came and helped me launch the book right before it came out in my hometown. And it's been a great experience to be able to work so closely on this common goal, which is to honor his mother's legacy and also challenge all of us for the future. That's what we both want. So,
And did Max ever write anything about his experience from his side of it?
He didn't write anything, but he has been interviewed. He was interviewed, and I would like to just say how grateful I am to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, not just for being there, but for the archives that they have put online. They have put hundreds of oral interviews of Holocaust survivors online, and you can go to their website and you can pull up Stefania Podgorska's interview. You can pull up Joseph Brzezinski, aka Max Diamant's interview, and you can hear them talk about their story in their own words. And anyone can do that. It is publicly available, and it is an incredible service that they've done.
Wow. Well, Sharon, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
Mom, do you have some final words?
I do. This book is the story of two courageous women who prove that, yes, one person truly can change the world.
Absolutely.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.